From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made somewhere on an unnamed flight earlier, probably last month, maybe the month before even, when the first cases of the Omicron COVID variant arrived in this country. It's here in New York State. It's in California, Colorado, and other states. It's in dozens of countries. The hope of containing Omicron was always fleeting. There remains much we don't know about this COVID variant. It's clearly quite transmissible, but it's not clear how deadly it is. Soon we'll know. We can hold out hope that it's a milder flavor of COVID, but we don't have a basis to say that yet. Meanwhile, the federal government is trying to respond and prepare, and that means many different levels, including public health and the economy. My guest this hour will discuss the federal response to the new variant, the recent infrastructure bill, the state of politics in the country right now, and more. Congressman Joe Morelli, welcome back to Connections.
Hey, Evan, it's nice to be with you.
Well, let me just start with Omicron, and I guess I'm curious to know about your level of concern for this so far.
Well, I think we're all concerned about it. You know, from the very beginning, you know, trying to understand the nature of the virus, the original COVID virus, and then each successive variant carries with it a number of questions that you want to have answered. And you also want to prepare people for best practices. So I think the three things that we're focused on right now in terms of the federal government and the public health community is, what is the transmissibility of the virus? I'm not sure. What you said is it's very transmissible. I don't know that the science has proven that it's more transmissible, but that's clearly one of the things that we need to know. The second, which is as important, maybe more important, is what's the strength or how lethal is this variant? And there's some concerns about the way that the proteins sit on the top of the virus and whether that suggests that it has an easier ability to attach to human cells and whether that means it's more deadly. But that's the second thing. And then the third question, of course, is to the degree that people are vaccinated and have booster shots, how do those vaccines, how efficacious are they against this particular variant? We know that they do well against COVID. We know that they do well against the Delta variant. The question is on Omicron, can we be certain of that? And the good news is we're able to react much more quickly. I have to say South Africa has been incredibly helpful. Their scientists have been, and they were as a nation quick to invite people in, get information to us. So, you know, we're working on all these questions. In the interim, while we're working through those, and I think we'll know, we'll have laboratory tests probably in the matter of days on the issues as it relates to transmissibility and how deadly or lethal this might be. And the question whether the vaccines work within a couple of days. I think the clinical tests will probably take a couple of weeks. In the interim, what we know is people should get, who are not vaccinated, should get vaccinated. Those who are eligible for boosters who have waited the requisite number of months should get their booster shots. People should mask. People should maintain distance. People should do all the things that public health officials have been telling us because we know that works. So we're working hard at it. I think, you know, what people have said and what we've been briefed by public health officials, we need to be concerned. We need to take this seriously. We need to move quickly. We do not need to panic. And so we're trying to advise people of all of those things.
When it comes to a travel ban, the Biden administration enacted a ban, or I should say restrictions on 8 countries, all African countries. But this virus is already everywhere, and it might have come from the Netherlands. I cannot figure out the purpose of this travel restriction. Can you?
Well, I think, you know, hopefully they'll be continuing to revisit the issue. There's this hope, I think, that people believe, and we kind of learned our lesson from this, I think, which is that it can be stopped by stopping people from traveling back and forth. But as we now know, if it's anywhere, it's everywhere. I mean, just the nature of global travel, the nature of goods and services flowing, it's really not possible to contain it by erecting, you know, walls, by not having people travel. The way to contain it, the walls that you build are by having people be vaccinated and people taking the necessary steps to mask and to stay away from gatherings. And, you know, one of the reasons these variants continue to be a concern is because not enough people still are vaccinated in the United States. And I understand people's concerns about their personal freedoms, but we've now seen 750,000 Americans die of this virus. So this is not some, you know, philosophical or theoretical discussion. This is, you know, in practice, people are dying and the hospitals are filling up again. You talk to folks not only here, but across the country, hospitals are filling up. And what that means, and you know this, and I'm sure your listeners know this, that means people can't get hospital beds. People can't get elective surgeries, which, you know, elective simply means you get to choose the time and place of the procedure, not that it's not critical. And we know that people have died over the last 18 months because they couldn't get access to service in hospitals, which were filled with COVID patients. So this is profound, and people can take and should take the necessary steps, and we need to do everything we can to encourage it.
Well, and encouraging is one thing, and there's been different responses in this country and different responses around the world. Olaf Scholz is the incoming chancellor of Germany. His recent suggestion was that everyone ought to be in that country vaccinated by February. And the German health minister, Jens Spahn, said last week that Germans will be vaccinated, cured, or dead by the end of February, all of them. I mean, that's a strong statement on mandatory vaccination. We don't have that quite level of mandatory anything in this country, whether it's masking or vaccination. And I'm wondering if you think that that should change in any way.
Well, I think there's a practical issue, which is you're not going to get everyone to do it, no matter best efforts. I think the president has been right to insist on certain size companies having mandates. I think the governor has been right to insist on healthcare employees being vaccinated anywhere where you're with people. And I had, you know, a gentleman came up to me. I was back home and at an event, and he came up to me and he said, "I don't know why the governments are telling us we need to vaccinate. I have personal freedoms." And I said, "You absolutely have personal freedoms, but your personal freedoms don't extend to being able to transmit a deadly virus to other people. I suppose, maybe if you think about it, if you want to stay home and be unvaccinated, that's your right to do. I think it puts you at risk because it's hard to guarantee you can't get the virus through people who just come to visit your house, but that's a risk you take. Problem is you're passing along to other people, and I'm not sure why people don't understand that your personal freedoms, particularly, well, that they don't stop when it comes to the possibility of endangering the lives of other people. But I still think, you know, this America, we have a different ethos than they do in Western Europe, and there's going to be limits to what you can force people to do, but they're going to pay a price. And the nation is already paying a price. And this isn't just a price around public health, as important as that is. The economic challenges we're facing now are directly attributable to the fact that so many Americans refuse to get vaccinated. This virus is still reaching so many people and affecting so many healthcare facilities, et cetera. There's a direct correlation to all this. So I think we're going to continue to push people to do the right thing here.
Yeah. And
what I find interesting, too, is this evidence that someone said to me recently, "Well, I'm not going to take the virus because I don't know what's in it." And I said, "Well, do you know what's in a polio vaccine? I mean, are you a scientist? But I assume you had your children and you've been vaccinated against polio, diphtheria, tetanus, smallpox, chickenpox, and probably certainly more than that. And do we question what's in those viruses? The politicization of this virus has jeopardized the lives of millions of Americans, and I don't understand. I struggle to understand it, but I also recognize there's a certain reality."
Well, and so the federal government has tried for the last, but going on 2 years now, to help make sure that there's not an economic collapse. There's interesting economic numbers right now. The workforce participation rate is the best it's been in a while. That's a very good sign.
Yeah.
But at the same time, the current numbers, the new jobs gained, weren't great for the last month, not as good as hoped. So there's sort of mixed messages. And the concern with this new variant is, you know, I don't hear anybody, congressman, saying it's likely to set us back to zero. I mean, there's probably not going to be complete immune escape. But I am hearing experts say if this thing is both more transmissible and more virulent, it's going to be another hard winter. And the question becomes, what is the responsibility of Congress? What's the responsibility of the federal government? How much political will is there to step in again? I'm curious to know if you think Congress will have a role if this becomes another, you know, sort of economic impacting strain of this virus.
Well, I can tell you this. There are a number of members of Congress right now who are trying to stop our continuing resolution to fund the government because they demanded that the federal government not spend a single penny to enforce mandates on vaccines. So that's the response from some members of Congress, is to make sure that the federal government plays no role in assuring that the mandates that are in place are actually followed. So if you can think about that, we're requiring members of the military to be vaccinated. If you want to be in the United States military, because the Department of Defense and the branches have taken the position that you're a threat to the other men and women who are war fighters if you're not vaccinated. So there are members of Congress trying to stop the enforcement of that mandate. So to your point about political will, what's happening here is there are a large number of members of Congress who are trying to stop the government's effort to keep people safe, which I find, frankly, extraordinary, except in the 117th Congress, it's really hard to find anything extraordinary anymore.
Okay. Well, on the subject of what, you know, sort of what could happen going forward or just dealing with a transmissible virus, this was a piece in the New York Times from Jonathan Martin just yesterday, writing about a Democratic pollster named Brian Stryker. Stryker convened focus groups to try to figure out why Glenn Youngkin won over so many voters in Virginia who cast a ballot for Joe Biden just a year ago. And Stryker tells the New York Times that two things stand out as big problems for Democrats. First, he says that voters perceive Democrats as not really caring that schools were closed for so long, and they blame Democrats for that. And second, voters said their biggest concern is the economy, and in their perception, Democrats are more concerned with cultural issues and not really doing anything to help people economically. Now, I want to start with schools. Do you think school closures went on for too long and have hurt kids?
Well, there's no question that being out of school hurts children. So, you know, the push to get kids back to school, I think, is the right one, but you don't want to do it under circumstances where you put their very public health or their very health in jeopardy and jeopardize the public health. So did we learn things through this? Absolutely. And as we deal, hopefully not, but if we're forced to deal with Omicron and it turns out to be highly transmissible or highly virulent, then we're going to have to confront these questions again. I think we can do it in a better way. I know the school district I lived in East Irondequoit, kids were back to school. They did not have a very long time out of school. So they were back much earlier than the Rochester City School District. West Irondequoit, likewise, kids were back. Many of the districts were out. And I think that I would be an advocate for having, under safe conditions, we have to create those conditions, have children back to schools as quickly as we can, because it does affect them. We've seen this in the city of Rochester, where the delays in having kids go back to school affected their abilities to continue to maintain grade level achievement. So I do agree that schools need to be open to the greatest degree that we can keep them open, but they also have to be safe. We're not going to jeopardize children. And what we do know is early indications are Omicron is affecting a younger cohort of people. Now, that may be because more seniors are vaccinated. I mean, there may be a whole host of reasons. It may not be a biological reason. But we need to be thoughtful about how we do this. And what we also know is that there simply isn't a good way to do distance learning yet in the United States, particularly in communities of color and in rural areas. So, you know, we're trying to deal with that, by the way, with the infrastructure bill that we've just passed and the Build Back Better Act, which we hope will get back from the Senate soon. So we're trying to invest in people, and we're trying to get kids in school because they do have there is a better experience there. I don't think there's any question about that. Frankly, if we erred on the side of keeping them healthy and safe, I'm okay with that. Let's just make sure that the lessons we've learned over the last year and a half, we apply should we have to, you know, deal with this variant or another that we're worried is really doing damage to people.
Well, and the pollster Brian Stryker told the New York Times that the other main issue is that voters in Virginia largely told his groups that their perception was the Democrats are obsessed with identity issues and are not interested in the economy right now. What would you say to that?
Well, I would say that everything that we have done in the 117th Congress, whether it's rebuilding the nation's infrastructure, which sadly has had no attention for decades, all through the last administration, every week was infrastructure week. People kid around here. We finally did something about it. $1.2 trillion of infrastructure dollars to rebuild our roads and bridges, our water treatment systems, lead pipe removal, improve the opportunities to confront the climate crisis. All those things go into infrastructure. So that's something, and by the way, that's going to have an enormous economic impact. So we do care deeply about the economy. And the second thing I'd say is, when you look at what's in Build Back Better, the things that we're doing all relate to economic bottom line issues for families. So whether that's reducing the cost of health care, reducing the cost of prescription drugs, whether that is making child care more affordable for all American families, whether it's a child tax credit, which will help families deal with the costs that they deal with. Those are all economic issues. Now, when we talk about the economy, though, we're talking about people at the lower and middle income levels. We're not talking about billionaires. I mean, the Republicans point to the 2017 tax cuts. 83% of the benefit of that went to people who are billionaires, make millions out. The top 1% of Americans received 83% of the benefit. And at a time when economists suggested we didn't even need to do it because the economy was moving along as it had for several years under President Obama and continued under President Trump. So we care deeply about the economy, but we care about the economy rising for all people, that the disparities, particularly by people of, in communities of color that haven't participated in that economic growth, that they be part of this. So, yeah, the notion that we care only about cultural issues, when people say that, they're suggesting that somehow we shouldn't be paying attention to trying to create a more equitable society. And if that's the argument, I would strongly disagree. We're trying to do both things, to try to make sure that we address all those disparities that have occurred, not for decades, but centuries, and that we build an economy that works for all Americans, not just a handful of Americans.
There were several reports last month that Democrats are looking for the right person to run for president against Donald Trump in 2024 and that President Biden should serve one term. Do you agree with that?
Well, I'd say the only person who's defeated Donald Trump for president is actually Joe Biden, and by millions of votes. So, you know, I think it's way too early. I this obsession that everyone has with elections, as though they're football games or sporting events, I think is just is really a detriment to the country. You know, it's true that the job of government is boring if you take out sort of the politics and the horse races and the polls. But maybe we need a little more boring these days and a little less entertainment value coming out of our, our governance, because the obsession. I mean, Joe Biden hasn't served for a full year of 4-year term. We're already talking about the next presidential election. So I think people in my business ought to focus on doing their jobs and worrying about that and not worry as much about what's going to happen in 2024, for God's sakes.
Well, let's talk a little bit about something that we saw happening this week in Washington. It's clear now that the U.S. Supreme Court is going to cut into Roe v. Wade in some way. It's not clear if it's a sort of a full rejection and send the issue back to the courts or just sort of upholding what's happening in Mississippi. But Justice Clarence Thomas repeatedly, for example, was asking a specific question this week. And Justice Thomas almost never talks, rarely asks questions. So this was pretty extraordinary. He was asking repeatedly, what is the legal argument for a right to an abortion? Justice Thomas made it clear he did not think he was given a direct answer. Can you articulate that?
Well, I think it's well articulated in Roe versus Wade. I think if Justice Thomas actually read Roe versus Wade, it articulates very well a woman's right to choose. It is embedded in the Constitution, not articulated directly the way some other rights are and protections, but the Supreme Court in 1970s made that decision in Roe versus Wade. He needs to read that. And, this whole, I find it fascinating. I think Clarence Thomas may go down in history as maybe one of the worst judges on the Supreme Court, certainly in the modern era. And it is extraordinary that he even bothered to ask a question because he's known for never speaking in court. But it's well established. As I think it was Kavanaugh said, Roe versus Wade was settled law. It's been 50 years in this country where the right that a woman has to her reproductive decision making has been for the better part of a half century part of settled law in the United States. So there is a compelling argument. And honestly, I think this will be if it does indeed come down the way that you're and I suspect it will, which is either a narrowing or a striking down altogether of that right. This will go down as one of the worst decisions the Supreme Court has ever made.
What is the...
I'd also find it ironic, I have to say.
Okay.
I find it ironic that some folks who are arguing so strenuously that the government shouldn't tell you to wear a mask during a public health crisis that's killed 750,000 Americans somehow thinks it's okay, though, for the government to force a young woman to have a child, as though that wasn't a personal right worth having and celebrating the United States. And frankly, this notion of viability, which Justice Roberts seems to suggest isn't the standard any longer, because he's talking about the, as I understand, the Mississippi law, it's a 15-week bar.
Yeah, yeah.
And he was suggesting that that would be potentially okay, and there was nothing necessarily special about viability. But in my view, one of the truly one of the most remarkable things about Roe versus Wade is the way the court balanced two different things, which was how do you protect the rights of the fetus when it's gotten to a point where it could survive outside the mother's womb, and yet balance that against the rights of a woman to be in charge of her health and her body. And the notion that Justice Roberts would somehow suggest that there's nothing particularly thoughtful about that or special about that. And he pointed to some private note that Justice Blackmun had put in the margin of an early draft as the reason for this. I mean, this is, in my mind, I think it's one of the most thoughtful parts of Roe versus Wade on the way that you balance that very, very important right of a woman to make sure that she and not the government makes decisions about her body.
Yeah, Ross Douthat in the New York Times recently wrote that there's a simple answer to the point that you're raising, which is that the conservative perspective is that abortion is an act of killing, and that it ought not be condoned. That killing is a problem. That's the distinction that he sees.
Well, it's a distinction he sees. It's not I'm not sure which part of it he was arguing, but it is a distinction that science doesn't recognize. It is the choice of a woman before viability under the settled law of the United States and the constitutional interpretation by the courts for the last 50 years that a woman's right is absolute until such time as viability is reached, which I think right now is between 22 and 24 weeks of pregnancy. And then after that, there have to be extraordinary circumstances in order to be able to intervene. Prior to that, it's a woman's choice. I think it should be absolute. I think it is embodied in everything the Constitution means. It is settled law, and I think this will be, as I said, I think one of the worst decisions this United States Supreme Court has ever made if it reverses it, which it does appear likely to do.
I respect and actually have affection for your condemnation of obsession with horse race politics, and so respecting that, let me just observe one thing here: the likelihood, yeah, given history and demographics, is that your party is at the peak of its governing power for maybe the next decade in Washington, and so a lot of voters who support what you're saying about Roe are wondering if this happens the way that you fear and that others fear. Is there a recourse in Washington? Is there anything legislatively? Is this simply going to be a states' rights issue going forward?
Well, I hate to argue with a premise that you've stated, but I'm just going to make the argument that I don't know that people know with any certainty what's happening in politics in the world and certainly in the United States the next 2 months, let alone
that's
the next
fair.
2 years or the next 10 years.
That's fair.
I think. I don't know that I see that. I think if Roe is either overturned completely or if it is narrowed, you will see efforts by people. Certainly, and I voted for a bill which would make it federal law that codifies Roe versus Wade, and we'll continue to push for that. But we will also, I'm sure, start to talk about a constitutional amendment so that it is articulated clearly that a woman's right to choose is a constitutional right. I believe it is. Obviously, most Americans believe it is by a pretty significant margin. I think nearly 60% of Americans believe that Roe versus Wade and the right that a woman has for her reproductive health is you know, that they support. So it's overwhelming that Americans do. So we may have to work on constitutional amendments. I don't want to prejudge it before the decision, but I'm sure people will begin to think about that, and I think they should.
Before I get to some listener questions, and listeners, will invite them, if you've got them, for Congressman Joe Morelli, who is our guest on Connections this hour. You can call us at 844-295-TALK. It's toll-free, 844-295-8255. You can email the program connections@wxxi.org. Probably nobody knows Irondequoit politics better than you, and the newly elected town supervisor there is Rory Fitzpatrick, a Republican who narrowly defeated your son, Joe Morelli Jr. Fitzpatrick told us on this program that when he talked to voters, first and foremost, they said they wanted a supervisor who would support their police. What do you make of that?
I think people are very concerned about policing in this country. I think they're concerned about it in Irondequoit. I think they're concerned about it in the city. I understand that. And I don't, the notion that some people are trying to make that if there's a binary question, whether you support police or whether you support police reform, is a false choice. And it's driven by people who want to make political gain. I think two things ought to happen. I think we ought to continue to reform police so that it is more respectful of black and brown citizens who have been routinely across this country treated differently. But we also ought to support law enforcement that is committed to that. And there's, you know, I would dare say a significant percentage of people in law enforcement locally and across the country committed to that reform because they join police forces and law enforcement for the right reasons. So I don't know why people want to make this a choice between one or the other. I support local law enforcement. I've worked long and hard with local law enforcement to get them resources to allow them to do their jobs. I also strongly support efforts to reform police activities so we demilitarize it, so that we eliminate procedures that are clearly not appropriate. And so I'll continue to do that.
Yeah, I mean, we do see sort of the loudest pundits and the cable news cycle and a lot of claims that, well, you know, President Biden wants to defund police, wants to abolish police. President Biden has been pretty similar to the new mayor of New York City's disposition on this, which is that we're not going to have a country where there are no police officers, that we're not going to eliminate police departments wholesale, but a review of their conduct is appropriate. So that sounds like where you are. Yeah.
Yeah, it is where I mean, honestly, I'm in the community a lot. When I'm not in Washington, I spend, you know, most of my time at community events. I'm in the city quite a bit, and I spend time with faith leaders. I spend time with neighborhood groups. What they'll say is, we don't want to defund the police. We need the police because often people in our neighborhoods are the victims of crime and violent crime. But we also don't want our sons and daughters to fear going out on the streets because of inappropriate police activity. To me, that sounds like an entirely reasonable position for people to take, people who are affected, unfortunately, more by violence than people maybe out in the outer suburbs. You know, that's what I hear repeatedly. That is perfectly aligned with how I feel about this. We're going to continue to work for these reforms. They're important. They're critical. They're necessary. They're long overdue. But we're not going to do it at this in the way that some people have suggested we're going to do it, by defunding the police. That's not going to happen. And I certainly won't support it.
Finally, on this issue, before we turn to listeners, what we're going to do is this. We're going to finish up on this issue. We're going to take a break. We're going to come back. I want the congressman to share with us a little bit more about how he sees the current work in Washington, whether that's infrastructure or Build Back Better, et cetera, impacting us. And then we're going to take listener calls here. I'm curious to know if you take seriously the criticism from Laron Singletary, Rochester's former police chief, who is now a Republican candidate for the congressional seat that you hold. We'll see if he gets that full nomination from the voters, but the Republican Party has thrown its support behind him. Joe Robach was there, Bernie Iacovangelo, and former Chief Singletary says Democrats have turned their back on police. Do you take that seriously?
Well, I'm not sure what Mr. Singletary means by that. I certainly haven't turned my back on police. I talk to law enforcement officials all the time. I'm interested in the resources they need, but I'm also continuing to press them to make important changes. So, no, I don't agree with that at all. And I think, honestly, I think Laron has a lot of questions answered about the way he conducted himself during the 6 months when he knew Daniel Prude died in police custody and didn't say a word about it. There's a lot of questions to answer. And we'll get to that at some point. But frankly, I haven't really thought very much about the campaign. So I'm trying to do my job here in Washington.
All right. Let's take our only break of the hour. We're coming back with Congressman Joe Morelli for the hour with us here on Connections. Coming up in our second hour, a conversation with gay Christians from different congregations and denominations. What it's like to be a gay Methodist, a gay Catholic. The Methodist Church is on the verge of a worldwide split over LGBTQ plus issues. And the U.S. Council of Bishops recently debated whether to deny communion to people like President Biden over these kinds of issues. We'll talk about it next hour. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Congressman Morelli, we've got the infrastructure bill coming our way here. What is top of mind for you that you think this region needs to understand is in this bill?
Well, first and foremost, you know, we've had, as I said, for now decades ignored basic infrastructure in this country. So that is roads, bridges, it's rail lines, it's the kinds of things we do to treat water, to make sure that lead pipes are removed from our system so that individuals aren't harmed by lead in the water. So a lot of that basic infrastructure has to get done. We just haven't invested nearly enough in that. So, you know, as Senator Schumer and I have done a number of events about the amount of money that will come, and we'll work with our local officials, city, county, certainly the state of New York, to identify the priorities that they have for bridges and roads that are just insufficient and our public health and safety. But the other, you know, big project that I'm really interested in, I spoke to the governor about 2 days ago. I've spoken to Secretary Buttigieg about is the Interloop project. We've seen the impact that the Interloop projects had along Alexander Street, and now we really need to focus on the Interloop North and to really bring those neighborhoods and downtown back together again. We've seen the impact of that, not only in Rochester, but many places around the country. So that's a project I'm interested in as well. So there are many, but I'm going to be consulting with people. And then my goal and my, my objective is to make sure that we're driving as many resources to the region as we possibly can. But this is a big deal. And it's not only going to help improve the infrastructure, but think about all the jobs that are going to be necessary to be able to do this work. And that's both in the construction trades all the way up through engineers and architects will have to do the work to design these projects. So I think the other big issue is how quickly can we get the dollars out to communities? And that's something we're going to work really hard to do as quickly as we can.
Okay. What's coming next in terms of Build Back Better and other efforts in Washington?
Well, you know, I really think about it this way, Evan, and I'm not sure it gets articulated this way, but I think infrastructure and Build Back Better go hand in hand in this way, that the infrastructure is about physically rebuilding the country. Build Back Better is about rebuilding, you know, people and families and making sure that they can all participate in this, what we hope will be a growing economy. So the parts that, and I mentioned some of this earlier, parts that I think are particularly important are the child tax credit getting extended. This has the potential, and we're already seeing this, of reducing child poverty by 50% in America, which may be the greatest single thing we've done since the 1960s under Lyndon Johnson. It may even be as important as anything since the New Deal as it relates to children and poverty. So I'm very proud of that. We've extended it. We're going to continue to work to try to extend it. Lowering the cost of childcare for all families. So this is for anyone who has children. They know that the amount of their weekly budget that goes to pay for childcare, which is preventing a lot of women. You talked about labor participation, which is getting better, but there are a lot of women still facing the difficult choice of going back to work because they tend to be the primary caregivers for children. So we're going to invest in that and try to bring down the cost of childcare. The other thing that has gotten some attention is, you know, using Medicare to negotiate the cost of prescription drugs, including insulin, which if the bill passes and the provisions that we passed stay intact in the Senate, will lower the cost of insulin to $35 a month, and is literally necessary for people who have diabetes. It's life-threatening if you don't have insulin. So, you know, these kinds of things I think are long overdue. I think when people start to hear about it, I think they're going to recognize that there was a lot of work done in the 117th Congress to address the needs of families. So I'm really excited about that. The other thing that's in there, which hasn't gotten very much attention, something I've been working on, $3.36 billion to create regional innovation hubs. And this is an idea that I've worked on with a number of economists out of MIT, the Brookings Institute, which says that 90% of all the private venture capital money in the United States goes to five cities and places like Rochester and other communities in the Midwest that have great ecosystems for innovation aren't getting the kind of attention. So increased federal investment in those places, which will then bring private investment. I think Rochester is positioned as well as any community in the country to take advantage of something like that. So these are things that we're doing that will really rebuild everything. We want to build a greater economy. The notion that somehow Democrats aren't interested in it is folly. We just want it to be inclusive. We want everyone to share in it. The American dream shouldn't be reserved for certain people in certain neighborhoods, certain zip codes. It should be available and open to every single American. And that's, you know, that's what brought my grandparents to the United States and millions of immigrants, was the notion that everyone, if you put in hard work, you can succeed. The rules will be fair for everyone. Just follow them and abide by them, and you can you know, do wonderful things for yourself and for your families. And it's been denied to too many people just for too long.
When we talked several months into this pandemic in 2020, there was a lot of discussion about how to help people quickly and efficiently. And, right, you know, there were calls across the country. Hey, look what Canada's doing. Look what other places are doing. Just make it simple. Write a check. Do UBI. You know, it's not like you came on this program and endorsed UBI, but you said, you know, you were open to more efficiency in a way of helping people, yeah, in need. Have your views on universal basic income changed at all?
No, I'm still open to talking about ways of doing exactly what you said. And I think actually, if you look at Build Back Better, there are certainly elements of that. So childcare, which I mentioned, you know, we're hopeful of making certain that no family pays more than 7% of their income towards childcare. That's a way of ensuring, particularly lower income levels, that they either get childcare paid for or they get a significant subsidy. But that goes all the way up to people making $100,000, $200,000 a year, potentially, that everybody would be limited in the amount of their budget that would have to be devoted to childcare. The same is true of early childhood education. 3- and 4-year-olds getting universal early childhood education. That helps reduce the cost for families. The child tax credit, which now is $3,600 for every child under the age of 6, and for every child over the age of 6, $3,000. So you think about it, if you have 3 children, 2 of whom are under the age of 6, you'd get $7,200 for those 2. The third one would be $3,000. That's $10,000 a year for families. That is basically guaranteed. So that acts essentially as a form of starting to look at some form of universal basic income. And I think and if you look at what happened over the last 18 months, I mean, the federal government isn't going to get enough credit. I think historians will look back and say the approach that we took, which certainly when you're dealing with big, big numbers and you're dealing with 300 million Americans, there's a lot that could have gone wrong. I'm sure people will be critical of it, but you weren't able to do it with a scalpel. This was really, you had to do something bold. You had to do it big. I think given where we were and the risks we faced, I think that we acquitted ourselves pretty well. Small businesses got access to the PPP, the Paycheck Protection Program. I hear every day small businesses telling me, hey, I couldn't have gotten through this without it. Do they still struggle? Sure. Are they struggling to find people to work in their establishments? I hear that every day as well. So There's up to $80 billion in Build Back Better to improve workforce opportunities for people. So, look, we have challenges, but there's nothing that we can't do if we can just put aside the politics a little bit and think about how do we get common ground and how do we invest in the American people.
Okay. And before I let me just squeeze in one more follow up to that, because you raised the question of getting people back to work. I passed a local Subway franchise looking for a sandwich the other day, and there was a sign on the window that said closed this afternoon, can't find staff. And this is out on Fairport Road. And I thought, okay, interesting. One narrative is, workers are lazy and they got used to not working and they just want to get paid to not work. I hear that from listeners. Another narrative that I hear is that workers finally realized that what they were being paid was not commensurate, it wasn't worth their time, and that they ought to be paid more and get better benefits before they come back and work tough jobs, hard hours, et cetera. Where are you on that?
Well, look, I think some people want to go back to work and their circumstances aren't allowing it. Hopefully, as we provide more support for childcare, as we support these families, they'll be in a position to be able to afford that to go back to work. I also think, look, there's a labor shortage. It's going to continue for some time, and it's a demographics issue. So when you have a shortage, given the law of supply and demand, people are going to be able to require more dollars to work, and they're going to be more competitive efforts to lure people to work. And that's something that is going to raise wages across the country. I think shortages typically do that. I will say one other thing, which I know people really don't want to address, and I think some people like keeping this as an issue, a political issue to score points on. But if you think about the number of people that want to come to the United States, maybe not to live, but simply to work and then go home at the end of the day, you think about what's going on at the southern border. There is, in my view, a way to resolve the issues that separate us. We could enhance border security, and we could enhance the ability for people to work in the United States, maybe even have a path to citizenship for those that want it. Not everyone does. But you have a shortage of workers. You have people who want to work, and many people want to keep alive the issue of the border security because it creates a fear, and fear drives votes. And I think it's one of the most irresponsible things that we could do is to not reach some kind of agreement on how to deal with immigration as a way to, again, increase our economic activity in the country and our economic prospects. And I don't think these are issues that you can't resolve. It's just a question of whether or not there's a will to resolve them.
Adam writes to the program to say, does the congressman agree it could be game over for maybe democracy, and at least for Democrats, if a strong Voting Rights Act is not passed?
Thanks for the question, Adam. I spoke yesterday in the Rules Committee, where I spend a lot of time. And while we weren't talking about the Voting Rights Act directly, we were talking about, subpoenas that people are ignoring and the question of whether or not we hold people in contempt for failing to testify about January 6th. But I think our democracy is in as much peril as it's been since probably the 1860s. And I worry every single day that the rule of law is not going to be followed. I think Steve Bannon and others have talked about their desire to change local elections to make it more difficult for Democrats to vote, make it more difficult for people of color to vote. This is now becoming a question of, if you say to people, well, if I win, it's fair, but if I lose, it's a rigged election, and then doing everything you can to try to deny people the opportunity to vote, I think these are all very important questions, and I don't think the question has been fully settled of whether this republic will endure. It will require us to pass voting rights protections for people. It will require us to make sure that we follow the rule of law. We're going to pass a bill, I think, next week in the House, sponsored by my friend Adam Schiff, who chairs the House Intelligence Committee and who was one of the impeachment lawyers, to strengthen our democracy, to give more power to Congress. The subpoena makes it harder for people to ignore the rule of law, and I think it's a really important piece of legislation. But I don't think it's a settled question. I think we are as much jeopardy now as we have been, as I said, in nearly two centuries.
A lot of emails here. Andrew says, what's happening in states like North Carolina is a good example of why Democrats are about to get railroaded. Republicans are drawing their own districts. Democrats are trying to play fair. Time to get tough. That is from Andrew. So let's talk a little bit about this. What he's talking about, I think, is that in, I don't remember seeing exactly the North Carolina map, but when you redraw the congressional maps, you can do it in ways where you know the voter rolls will favor one party or another. And in Ohio, my native Ohio, the maps look ridiculous. There are some supposed districts that span almost the state of Ohio. You'd have to drive 3.5 hours to get from one end of a congressional district to another in some of the drawn-up districts. That would greatly favor, yes, it's true, the Republican Party there, the Republican Party in North Carolina, the Sun Belt. Do you agree with Andrew, who says if Democrats don't also play dirty in this way, then you're going to get crushed in House votes?
Well, if you act like the opposition does, it means you sort of start to own their values. And I don't think we want to own the values of some of the places that he's talked about. What I do think, though, is we need to reinstitute the protections that were in the Voting Rights Act that have been gutted, preclearance and other issues which are important to protect minority voting rights. And you're right. In Ohio, they not only did they go after Democrats, Marcy Kaptur, who's a friend who's been longtime member, one of the most thoughtful, serious people in the Congress, is facing a very, very difficult election because of gerrymandering in Ohio. But they even went after their own. Anthony Gonzalez, who had the temerity to question January 6th's involvement in the insurrection against the United States, was drawn into a map that he can't win. So he decided to retire from Congress after just two terms. So it's important that you're going to redistricting and reapportionment has to be done every 10 years. The states are the responsible parties, but there are federal guidelines that need to be put back in place to prohibit some of the extreme gerrymandering that we've seen. And in North Carolina, it was only because the courts intervened and forced North Carolina maps to be drawn differently, as I think they did in Pennsylvania as well, that allowed there to be districts that were more appropriate than some gerrymandering that we're seeing. So I think there are federal rules that need to be put in place. The question will be whether or not it's possible under the current slim majorities in both houses to accomplish such a thing. We're going to work at it. We've passed the Voting Rights Act, John Lewis Voting Rights Act in the House. We're hopeful that Senator Schumer will be able to get that bill on the floor in the Senate and get it passed. But the National Republican Party has decided that absent any evidence of the 2020 election being, unfair or fraudulent, that they've decided now that they're going to do everything they can to make sure that these elections don't turn out the way that Democrats want and do turn out the way that the Republicans want. And it's, as I said, I think this is the greatest challenge to the Republican, to our democracy in centuries.
Writing from Irondequoit, Mark says, Democrats like to say they support racial inclusion and equity, but look at what they do. In Irondequoit, they wouldn't even support I Care. They always say the right things. They expect black votes, but they won't support black concerns when it comes down to it. That's a little inside baseball for those who don't know I Care, but what do you make of Mark's email?
Well, I don't think there's any question in the last 50 years which party has done more to try to expand the rights for black and brown people in this country. And frankly, any suggestion of the contrary is frankly ludicrous.
Sarah in Penfield says, I'm just hoping as a Democrat that we're going to learn the right lessons here. What would the congressman say is the lesson from the recent Virginia election?
Well, I think it's a great question, Sarah. We talk a lot about it. I mean, much of life is about how you communicate. And I think what Democrats need to do is, in a pretty simple way, describe to Americans what we're trying to do to build an economy that works for everyone and that includes everyone and that everybody has an opportunity, but everybody has to work. You know, the value of work and why it's important to us, and that we care deeply about all American families, just not a handful of American families, or those who are blessed in certain ways at birth. And so trying to create the more perfect union that our founders talked about when they founded the Republic. And that's the most important thing, and how to say that in a clear and compelling way. It's one of these things. Unfortunately, I remember back when I wasn't here in Washington, obviously, but when the Affordable Care Act was being talked about and people would be asked, How do you feel about the provisions of the Affordable Care Act? And people would say, oh, yeah, I support this, I support this, I support this. And yet they didn't support Obamacare because we just messaged it so poorly that we needed to tell people how their health care would improve. And instead, I think, you know, all the talk about death panels and some of the other crazy things that happened, we lost the communications battle. And I think if people hear our plans for the future, our vision of America, the values that Democrats care about, and we can say it in a clear and compelling way, people will vote for it. They did in 2020. We haven't changed in that regard.
Congressman Joe Morelli, we appreciate the time, and I will say that we're all hoping that this new COVID variant becomes sort of a non-story or is very mild, but we don't know. And if it becomes the trouble that we hope it is not, I hope we can stay in touch on federal response and more here. We always appreciate the time, sir.
You bet. Nice to talk, Evan. Thanks so much.
That's Congressman Joe Morelli on Connections, and we've got more coming up in just a moment.